Hello, my name's Tom Walker. Welcome to That'll Be the Day. With me today, I have a visually impaired star of radio, television, and social media. Whether it's Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, or Clubhouse, Lucy Edwards has loads of followers and a prominent presence. Before I speak to Lucy, if you like the music at the start of this podcast, it's a track called That'll Be the Day by the Liverpool band The Vow. I'll be playing it in full at the end of this podcast. Now, assuming my technical skills haven't let me down, Lucy should be on the other end of this Zoom call. Lucy, tell me you're there.
Hello, Tom.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be chatting to you because I know we've worked together before on several different programmes and I'm just really happy to be on. So thank you for inviting me.
You've amassed an awful lot of followers on social media, so I shall be interested to know about that. As you say, we've worked together, so the radio stuff will be interesting and the stuff you've done on telly too. Before we do all that, how's lockdown been for you?
Oh, Tom, I mean, I don't know how it's been for you, but for me, I think the first lockdown and the second lockdown was worse, just purely because I guess we were just adapting to a new normal. I know that term is coined by several people in the media, I guess, this sense of new normal. When we first locked down, it was the 7-year anniversary of me completely going blind. So it kind of was a bit of a pause and reverse for me. I was going to get married also in 2020 and we postponed that. And then also just the retired guide dog fiasco, that was the end of 2020 in October 2020 for me. So yeah, kind of my wings kind of got cut at the seams really a little while, but bounced back. And I'm sure other people can probably relate to me too.
Now, you're a freelancer like me. How was work for you during lockdown?
Yeah, it was tough, Tom. I think at the start of when everyone was kind of really just put out to sea and not knowing what was going on, it kind of just stopped for me dead in its tracks. And I was kind of sitting there thinking, wow, I had all these gigs. I was kind of actually at the start of lockdown, I filmed for the travel show. I actually went on an aeroplane for the first time with my now retired guide dog, and she was working amazingly back in early March 2020. And that package was going to go out, and it never ended up airing, which is kind of no fault of anyone's, because at the end of the day, 2 weeks later, there was no air travel anywhere. So from that perspective, kind of that program never saw the light of day. And we went just the stark contrast of that. And then several months later, Olga not really guiding me anymore, just because of her being at home a lot more with me. She's so used to being so dynamic. But yeah, so I think I lost jobs because of freelancing, and it is about the hustle. And I guess when, you know, the economy was thrown into turmoil, freelancers weren't necessarily, you know, the first thing on everyone's minds. So yeah, it was a bit scary.
What about more generally? Have you managed to survive lockdown? Have you managed to get out and do a bit of walking and maybe even a bit of socialising when it was relaxed?
Yes, Tom. Yeah, I've got to grips with it all now. I think when Olga kind of stopped working, it kind of jolted me out of my kind of funk in a way. I thought, I can't do this. And kind of August to October is when I started uploading on TikTok and saw massive growth, because I just thought, wow, like, I can't sit here and not be Lucy and not be out there making videos and in the media world. That is who I am. I'm passionate about storytelling and hustling, and I love my line of work, and I wasn't prepared to let that go, and just like so many others out there. And yeah, I kind of got myself back to a bit of a normal. I bought a treadmill, I went out with Olgi, but kind of our new normal, no harness, and I started to go out with my cane. I hadn't touched my cane, Tom, in like 7 years. I probably shouldn't admit that, should I, because they always say keep your cane training up, but it was learning that all again. So yeah, it got better.
You mentioned there TikTok, so we may as well talk about social media first. You've become rather popular on TikTok and on other social media as well, including Twitter and Facebook and so on. What is the key to being popular on social media?
Wow, the key. I mean, it kind of exploded for me on TikTok just purely because of the hashtag learn on TikTok, which was trending back in August. And it was kind of TikTok's way of driving more educational content to the platform. I saw doctors on there. I saw other educators on there. And I thought, wow, this is really a time to do it. I think the success for me throughout my whole social media experience, I mean, I started social media back in 2014, where I uploaded to YouTube, Blind Girl Does Her Own Makeup. And that went viral. And then I trained to be a BBC journalist and kind of frequented social. But I definitely wanted to just make sure my skills were up to snuff before I started creating more content. And I think that has really driven my ability on TikTok this time around, coming back to it as a kind of an experienced journalist, an older creator now, I'm 25. I think learning how to write a good headline, learning how to piece together a good radio package. You know, I was taught by you and some other fantastic people who really were a part of my journey at the BBC, really teaching me how to put together radio packages and whatnot. It kind of was the building blocks to my success. And I think really taking that and then also saying, wow, this new medium, it's 1 minute or less. Like, how am I going to teach someone who knows nothing about blindness in 1 minute or less? I try and keep my videos under that if possible anyway. For me, it was about a series. For me, it was like about this key question, how does a blind girl? And I thought, if I can make this a brand and a series, people are going to come to me and think, well, how does a blind girl know about that? And at the start of every one of my videos, that's what I started to do. And kind of even before I started to upload on TikTok, that was sort of my strategy because of my experience at the BBC. Yeah.
Is TikTok mainly then a video platform?
Yes, all video, and it's very user driven. So it's very, you know, you respond to comments with stitch features, with duets. It's very interactive. And I think that's why my success was driven on those features, because there was an emphasis on that. I always had community engagement, people going, well, how do you brush your teeth? How do you pick up your dog's poop? How do you, you know, brush your hair? And I think fundamentally, sometimes that's a bit like, oh, wow, how do people not understand how I do that? But then I sit back and I tell myself, you know, before I had a disability, I knew nothing about disability. And if kids aren't being educated at school, or even adults, about how to be blind, let me be the blind educator. And to be honest, TikTok probably has a long way to go on voiceover accessibility. You can record a video in app, you can put some text on it, you can even upload a video that you've edited in Final Cut Pro, which is accessible with voiceover, and just plop it on and do all the hashtags and stuff. So it is getting more and more accessible by the day. I think when I first started, there were a lot of unlabeled buttons, but it's been a journey and I'm so excited to take it to the next level. And TikTok Listen.
You mentioned that you lost your sight. I think it must be what now, some 8 years ago. Does somebody help you with the videoing? Does somebody actually do the filming for you, essentially?
Yes. So because I'm a freelancer, I've applied for something called Access to Work. And this really does help me in my day-to-day life as a content creator and journalist running my own business. I know that you know, you have to be bright and bubbly on camera, but it is also important to engage with the sighted audience as well as a blind audience. And I think I have got my fiance, and then with the support of other access workers that I hire, I do have a support network around me. That's half the time, I would say, if I'm doing a sit-down video, I use the Measure app on my Apple iPhone. I measure it. I make sure the camera's level on my tripod. I just have a plain yellow wall and sit on my tub chair. I'm always sitting in the same position. My tripod never moves. If I do just want to sit down and just film a, how does a blind girl go to school? And I just sit and answer a question, that is fine. If I'm out and about, which a lot of my videos are, it really is that Access to Work funding coming into play. But I would say probably more videos than not I have had help with on TikTok, but I don't believe that has been the core of my success necessarily, because the platform is getting more and more accessible.
You mentioned there your branding, the How Does a Blind Girl. Do you think that that really has brought in viewers for you, that people are really, really interested to have these questions answered?
Yes, Tom. It honestly, it is completely centralized to my message that I'm always saying, how does a blind girl, in the start of my videos. This is what I kind of advocate for anyone starting on TikTok. Every social media is different, is what I would say. Long form content on YouTube probably wouldn't follow. Well, I know doesn't follow the same kind of formula, if you like, to be successful on there. With TikTok, it is about that question. It is about the answer, and it's about the audience really wanting to stay for that answer.
How do you regard your audience? Are they curious or just plain ignorant on visual impairment?
I would say curious. And I think I put it like that because I want to see the best in people. And I think if I wasn't throwing all of my positive energy at it, I wouldn't give the responses that people kind of deserve. Like I always say, like, I knew nothing about disability until I was a disabled woman. And I kind of think it's not a 14-year-old kid's problem necessarily, just scrolling through TikTok, that they don't know these answers, because school doesn't talk about disability or normalize it in any way at all. So I don't lie or lay the fault at the door of those individuals per se. I guess when the comments are really harsh and kind of questioning why I would want accessible tech because there's kind of no value to my life, and pushes into that sort of rhetoric, I think that's when it gets hurtful and harmful, that people genuinely believe that just because I lost my eyesight, I'm not Lucy anymore. But I think a lot of my audience who follow me do realize that there is a life after sight loss. You know, I am blind, I'm not broken.
You mentioned there about journalism and the process of asking questions. You trained as a journalist at the BBC. How did you get into that?
I basically lost my eyesight at 17 and I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. And I always say, oh, that was a sighted Lucy's dream. And when I started uploading to YouTube, I knew that storytelling was now me. And I kind of found my voice. I saw a job ad on my computer on the BBC website called Extended Digital News. And basically it was positioned in the news team. And I basically wrote out this application. I was so excited and giddy that there was positive discrimination towards disability and getting disabled journalists into work, because it was something I was worried about when I first lost my vision. And then I started to train with such amazing journalists. I got that job. And I remember sitting in my mom and dad's house and screaming like, oh my gosh, I got in the BBC. Like it was such a moment for me that I thought would never happen. And yeah, I did a good 6 months at the BBC, just training and kind of absorbing everyone's amazing knowledge around me.
What's the key thing you learned at the BBC in terms of telling stories?
I always thought, wow, a good story is in kind of searching the internet and kind of happening upon a peg or a happening moment. And yes, it is about that, but what I really learned, really hone in on who you're chatting to, kind of a good talker, really understand where that person's coming from regarding the peg that they're sort of attached to. You know, who are they, what story are you telling? You know, because humans are so multifaceted. And at the end of the day, we're just having a glimpse in that one piece of content we're creating.
Now, in Christmas, 2019, I turned Radio 1 on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. and I heard your dulcet tones coming through the speakers, as did many other people. It was obviously a brilliant thing for you to have achieved. How did you do it? And what was it like working for Radio 1 and doing a live show?
Radio 1, wow. I think that was the most nerve-wracking thing in my whole career. One of the most amazing things, but the most nerve-wracking. I'm going to be blunt with you. I had blue tack on those sliders And no one at Radio One had ever worked with a blind person. So, and also me being so young and kind of new to the live radio scene, in a sense, I kind of told people what I needed and wanted, but because I'd never done it loads previously in kind of like a live setting, I felt that my performance wasn't the best that I could possibly do. And I know that everyone around me was like, you're amazing. And, you know, in retrospect, yeah, I was so cool. Like, I was coming from a place where I hadn't done lots of live shows. So I thought I did a really good job. And at the end of the day, all Radio One could work with was the Lucy back then. And I think in retrospect, it is about an accessible studio and it is about getting your mind in the zone for live shows just because they're so different. And I think because they'd never had a completely blind person on a radio studio set up like that, there was no talk back. There was no counting. It was definitely a tap on the shoulder. And I think that's kind of what made me a bit more nervous to present in the best possible way that I know that I can. I guess when you have more controls, kind of like when I'm used to presenting packages for Radio 4, I am the commander of my destiny there. Like, I have the controls to my own buttons and I'm 3, 2, 1, go. And I think being stripped of that in that sense is was quite disconcerting for me.
I'm going to ask you a very nerdy question here. Was the producer in the studio with you so that as the tracks were playing, he or she was just talking to you about what you were going to do next and how you were going to do it? How did it work practically?
They were really helpful in the sense that they were next to me. I had my MacBook on, where the questions and comments got pulled through to my MacBook. And she was talking me through things to say and bits and bobs on my screen. Like, I can't really falter there. I think in that sense, it was really helpful. I think Blue Tack falling off on some points and me not having the true, like, 3, 2, 1, going over my beds type of thing was kind of disconcerting at times. So there was things about that experience that were amazing and that I think didn't need to change. And I think another, you know, and half of it maybe I can see how with maybe other access workers, other talkback technology and more controls on my end, I can feel a more confident version of myself. So it was half and half for me, Tom, really.
Yeah, I've got another one though. You're doing your link, you know, between each record and suddenly you think, OK, I want this record to start now. Were you in control of that by opening the fader, or did somebody else do that for you? How did that work?
Yes, I was in control of opening the fader. What I found disconcerting was not hearing 3, 2, 1 in my ear. It's obviously different for every blind person. But yeah, no, I was in control of the fader and also fading it down. But I think for me, I would have liked a bit more talk back.
On a scale of 1 to 10, as you woke up on that Saturday morning, how nervous were you as you made your way into Radio One?
The most nervous I've ever been in my whole entire life. probably up there with, my eye operations. I know that sounds horrendous, but I think it was kind of like, also, I was the first ever blind presenter. The weight of that on my shoulders and kind of, I don't know, like, I felt this was such a groundbreaking moment and it was on me. I kind of was like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. Like, hopefully there's going to be people after me that have accessible studios and this, that, the other. That was all running through my head. I was like, oh my gosh, little Lucy's would be so proud of me. Like, there's been no representation before this. Like, oh my gosh, like, I would have only dreamed of this like 5 years ago for there to be this much acceptance of me and my disability. And it kind of, like, after those shows, there was so much adrenaline in me that I literally just cried.
When you opened the fader and delivered your first link, I imagine at that moment you felt a real huge amount of pressure not to fluff your lines.
Yeah, I was really shaking, Tom. And it's honestly not like me. Like, I'm such a chatty Cathy, like, you know me. I don't do that. Like, it kind of was an out-of-body experience. It really was. You know, it was like world-shaking for me, Tom. That whole thing, social media blew up. Like, I really did put a lot on and an onus on me really doing that well.
You're probably fed up of talking about Radio 1, but one final question. Did you get to go into the studio before the programmers, maybe a few days before, to try and familiarise yourself? Or was it all completely new?
Yes. So I had 2 hours, I think, several weeks before, just because studio space is so crazy up in that building. If I was probably, again, on retrospect, an older person, I maybe would have pushed for more.
One of the other high profile things you've done for the BBC is television. What were the challenges for you as a visually impaired person of getting your head around all the requirements that television has?
With telly, there's always going to be a camera person there, because there is that expectation that, you know, I'm not going to get the angles and shots that another TV journalist is going to get. And especially, I want to put a special shout out to BBC Click. BBC Click are a phenomenal team. And Paul and Simon, who run Click, I trained with Paul. He also came on the Extend scheme, Paul Carter. He is just a phenomenal journalist. And he's been my cheerleader with inside that team, you know, to get the best out of me and my sort of working processes as a blind journalist. It's to do a session where we do voiceover separately, maybe the day after.
If you could give one piece of advice to a visually impaired person who's thinking about working in television, but also concerned that he or she, being unable to see, would be able to make a really good piece, what advice would you give them?
I would say you can do it. It is possible, but there is training. I've had training in looking at a camera. I've had a lot of experience in training myself where to look, training myself on writing a script or speaking a script from an earpiece and verbatim talking back the script. It was a massive learning curve for me, and there has to be a lot of passion in it. I love it so much that I kind of threw every bit of my being into it. It's not impossible. It really is not. Unfortunately, in this industry, we are underrepresented on screen and behind the screen as disabled journalists. And it is about having the strength in your own convictions to say, you know, this is how I work and this is how I do things.
You mentioned there underrepresentation, and that is a big issue, particularly for disabled journalists. Why do you think that is the case, and what needs to be done to tackle it?
I think it really is about not always doing the same things that we've always done in our industry. What I mean by that is there are amazing presenters that always get put on screen. And there are always amazing producers behind the screen that are producing phenomenal bits of work. But I think it is also coming out of that comfort zone and saying, hey, there are other people that maybe aren't able-bodied or aren't, you know, the typical people who usually do those roles, and really seeing the value in what other experience can bring. We might not work in the same way, but I think when we get disabled journalists and professionals into these higher roles, into SBJ roles, senior broadcast journalist roles, into editorial roles, that is when we see the change. I mean, I definitely have with Click. Like, Paul Carter is a senior journalist. He's amazing and has worked at his craft for years, and he's really championed me in my career. You know, there are different ways of working, especially with the pandemic, Tom. You know, we've all been on our computers, and we've all adopted a different way of working. It's possible to look at things differently. And I really do urge anyone listening to this who wants to really champion disabled journalists and be an ally, we need you more than ever.
Do you think the media organisations have done way too little to promote and support disabled journalists?
I think also that's a massively multifaceted question. I know there is a lot of funding being pumped in. For me, I haven't seen it trickle down yet, but that doesn't mean to say I've lost hope. I think if I do lose hope, I kind of might be sad, because it's just my dream to continue striving and pushing for equality, you know, and seeing so many amazing programs on screen that we haven't seen yet, or we haven't explored, not just from my minority group as a blind woman, as a disabled woman, other minority groups that I believe we haven't even tapped into half of it yet.
Lucy Edwards, it's been amazing to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And as promised, at the end of every podcast at the moment, I'm playing That'll Be the Day by the Liverpool band The Vow.
I bless my inner visions of you. So what if that's a strange thing to do? My heart won't stop bleeding, always needing, it just keeps leading me on. Down through the years, beating the way into your life, yeah, that'll be the day. Your open invitation comes my way. That'll be the day when all my inhibitions melt away. And who is not to say, we'll raise the shallow wreck of yesterday. If only I knew how. I've died too many times on this stage by slow. Well, that'll be the day. Your open invitation comes my way. That'll be the day when all my inhibitions melt away. And who is not to say, we'll raise the shallow wreck of yesterday. If only I